So, this is where I thought you would be. Do you want to go someplace different, or?
No, that's fine.
Good morning, everyone. Hopefully our audience might build a little bit as we go on. I know that there has been a room change, and so that might be affecting our group. But I'm Kristen Smith, and I'm one of the members of the Trade and Health Forum. And we have these blue flyers on the back table for the forum, which brings together a cross-cutting people from sections all over APHA. There's actually 400 people who have signed up to be a member of the Trade and Health Forum, and what we look at is how international trade and public health interrelate from a variety of perspectives, everything from effects on alcohol and tobacco control, access to medicines, environmental health, occupational health and safety, and there's also a sign-in sheet if you're interested in becoming part of the Trade and Health Forum and being on the listserv. A lot of people are already on it, but sort of started going back that way too. So in today's session, we will span a couple of topics here. We'll be talking about an update on the status of international trade agreements, and then we'll have a talk about public health and building a public health policy agenda in international trade from the perspective from Chile, and then two talks on different aspects of access to medicine. So our first speaker will be Ellen Schaefer. Many of you know her. She's one of our founding members of the Trade and Health Forum, and has done lots of work over the years on women's health, access to health care, and she's definitely one of the premier people in the world on international trade and public health as co-director of the Center for Policy Analysis on Trade and Health.
Thank you, Kristen. Sure. Yeah, I think our speakers would like to get a view, so please feel free. Yeah, there you go. So thank you all for being with us this morning and finding your way from wherever it was listed that we were supposed to be to finding where we actually are. The forum is a really exciting opportunity to bring together a cross-cutting view of how the global economy is intersecting with public health and our lives as public health professionals and advocates. This is just a disclosure I'm required to have by APHA. I'm going to really just use two slides for this presentation. So This is basically going over major trends that are facing us in globalization and economic globalization and public health at the moment, and I'll wrap up by talking about the public health objectives for global trade. Over here, when we talk about the NAFTA case, which some of you may have heard about, we're honored and delighted to be joined by Dr. Joel Lextion from Canada, who's looked at the case a little bit, and we've communicated back and forth, so we'll hear a bit more about that. Let me just start with the current climate, which is familiar to all of us. When we're talking about global trade agreements, we're really talking about efforts internationally through the World Trade Organization, which is a relatively recent establishment that was created in 1995 to regulate globally a number of spheres of economic activity, from trading goods across borders, which was the origin of the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, to looking at how we trade services, including healthcare services, how we trade pharmaceuticals, how we trade agriculture, all kinds of new services, things, commodities that have not been part of economic and international regulation in the past. With the collapse of the financial economy starting in the U.S. and rippling out to the EU, other developed nations, and emerging nations, which there was some thought that emerging nations would be safe from the downfall of our speculative economy, there's really a question about how our economies are going to function, to say nothing of how these new regulatories are going to work. So I'll talk a little bit about what's going on with the World Trade Organization that I am aware of, discuss a bit what's going on with pending free trade agreements, and then go on to discuss some of the other issues. And I think there's a sign-up list going around. In terms of the World Trade Organization, the General Agreement on Trade and Services has been a focus of this group, of CPATH and also the Trade and Health Forum, because it relates so closely to rights that we have as public health regulators. The discussions that I have heard internationally and been part of, there's a group called Our World Is Not For Sale that pulls together a number of NGOs and other organizations that have been active around the biannual WTO meetings. And there's been some discussion about whether the WTO will continue to exist, whether as public health advocates we should look for alternative structures of coordinating accreditation standards, movement across borders of healthcare personnel, services in themselves. At this point, there's a focus within GATS on looking at commitments that countries have made to financial services, in other words, agreements that countries have made to make it easier for financial services to move across borders. And clearly, this is a timely discussion since the free flow of speculation has had very discernible consequences to the global economy. There is supposed to be a Bretton Woods II meeting starting in the Bush administration as early as November 15th, when these international conversations will start. The World Trade Organization itself continues to schedule meetings in Geneva, but I think we're all expecting that the outcome on November 4th is going to play a big role in determining the direction of policy and the viability and standing of the U.S. and our ability to call these kinds of meetings and play a role. The three free trade agreements that I've listed up here, which are free trade agreements between the U.S. and these other three countries, are significant for a couple of reasons. We did pass the Peru Free Trade Agreement with significant changes in intellectual property rules that will make it less difficult than previous agreements have made it to assure that that countries will be able to provide access to affordable medicines and remove some of the barriers, such as data exclusivity, to access to generic drugs. Those same rules would apply, those changes would apply to the Colombia agreement if it were entertained and passed, but it appears to be stalled for pretty good reasons: the election, the level of violence in Colombia. This may come back up next year. There is a strong push by people, by the Bush administration and by trade ministers in Colombia, to try to entertain that agreement this year. And if there's a lame duck session of Congress, that could come up. The agreement with South Korea is much more likely not to go anywhere this year. It's another a country that until a couple of weeks ago had an economy pretty similar to the U.S. There were strong objections both from the health sector in Korea as well as from auto and beef producers in the U.S. to seeing that agreement go forward, but we could see that on the agenda early next year. As many of you know, CPATH and many of you in this room have been involved in thinking about how public health can play a role in trade policy, and we've looked at the trade advisory committees that are established to bring the word from the public to the U.S. Trade Representative, which is a branch of the executive government. There has been a lawsuit as well as an advocacy campaign to expand the 30 or 35 or so industry and agricultural products specific advisory committees that have a direct route to the USTR to include tobacco control advocates, public health advocates. There has been some success in that regard. We've had a tobacco control advocate appointed to the Agricultural Trade Advisory Committee on Tobacco, Cotton, and Peanuts, and there have been people appointed to the committees on intellectual property and pharmaceuticals, but there are also environmental reps on some of these committees, but there's a growing sense, including from the environmental folks who have been on much longer, that having one lone voice writing a minority report on these committees is useful, and it's a way to get the word out and coalesce an analysis, but it's really not functional in terms of getting the voice of our communities into policy and effectively to the federal government. The Ways and Means Committee of the U.S. House of Representatives, with the leadership mostly of Representative Lloyd Doggett and Mr. Rangel and Mr. Levin's offices cooperating, there are plans to hold hearings early next year to revisit the whole structure of these advisory committees, which are pretty much put in place in 1974 when the Trade Act was first enacted. I'll skip just to the positions of the presidential candidates and then come back to the NAFTA case, which Joel hopefully can discuss, talk to us about. Very simply, the positions have been boiled down to pro-free trade, anti-free trade. Both McCain and Obama have actually said reasonable things about the pharmaceutical provisions of these trade agreements as well as their effect on the economy. But at this point, the discussion is pretty much polarized in looking at McCain as somebody who would continue the trajectory of trade agreements as the trade policies that we've adopted and pursued under the Bush administration. The Obama campaign has talked a lot about revisiting NAFTA and revisiting all of the trade objectives. And I'll talk a little bit about the public health objectives after after we hear from Joel. I would have to say, and I'm interested to hear from folks in the room, I think that the economic advisors that Obama has, first of all, are going to be very busy with a lot of things, but also come at pretty much out of, I think, not the Chicago school, but the Robert Rubin school, which is still a pretty neoliberal approach to trade agreements. I think they're very interested. There is a trade caucus that is part of the House of Representatives, and Jason Furman, who's been leading the economics team for the Obama campaign, has been talking to those folks. I think they will need to hear from us a lot should Obama be elected after next week, and certainly McCain will. But I think there's going to be a lot of work to do in terms of really having a broad and wide-ranging discussion with either candidate. So that's the large picture. Joel, would you like to discuss the NAFTA case and where it's at and what the implications are? Joel Lexton, thank you.
Thanks, Ellen, for the opportunity. So just a little bit of background information. So NAFTA allows countries to take sectoral reservations so that the provisions of NAFTA don't apply for certain kinds of services. So Canada has taken that a sectoral reservation for healthcare services, but that only applies to the extent that healthcare is established and maintained for a public purpose. Second piece of background information is Chapter 11, which is unique among trade agreements as far as I know. Chapter 11 allows foreign corporations to sue governments. So under NAFTA, either a Mexican company or an American company can sue the Canadian government. And the third piece of background information is that although Canada has, by and large, private, not-for-profit healthcare facilities, so there are no private for-profit hospitals in Canada, over the past 5 to 10 years, provincial governments have allowed the growth of for-profit healthcare facilities, surgical clinics, day surgical clinics, diagnostics clinics, that kind of thing. British Columbia has got a number of these, including one that's owned by a past president of the Canadian Medical Association. And because of the growth of these private for-profit clinics, there's an investor in Arizona who, together with I think about a couple of hundred people, wanted to establish a private for-profit surgical clinic in British Columbia. And for reasons that aren't completely clear from what I've read, he's not been able to go ahead with that. So he's taking the position that an American company is being discriminated against under NAFTA, which is illegal under NAFTA. There's the national something clause where all corporations in all countries are treated the same as domestic corporations. So he's taken the position that he's being discriminated against, and on July the 11th filed a letter, what's called a letter of intent, which is a prelude to a lawsuit against the Canadian government. If this goes ahead, he's going to sue the Canadian government for $4 million in costs that he says he's incurred in the process of trying to set up this clinic, and then an additional $150 million in lost profits. So after a letter of intent is filed, there's a waiting period of 90 days, and then you can go ahead and launch your lawsuit. So the 90 days expired on October the 9th, and last night I Googled this man's name and didn't come up with anything new, so it's unclear whether or not he's going to proceed. And I've also talked to a public interest lawyer in Canada who's dealt with cases like this, who doesn't think that this one has much of a chance of succeeding, but who also views this as the tip of the iceberg. And to the extent that Canada allows more for-profit clinics, that we can expect to see more of these lawsuits. That's it.
You want to step here and I'll just run through the objectives and we'll have some Q&A? Sure. Okay.
Well, actually, I'll sit.
Okay, you can sit. All right, thank you. And I think the importance of, obviously this case is that what we're seeing with trade agreements is that they're being used in the health sector to privatize and deregulate services and healthcare regulations. So it's interesting to watch how our greatest fear is health advocates in the U.S., where we're trying to get a more accountable and universal system, as Canada has, is to think about how these agreements could be used to undermine that system. These are the public health objectives for global trade, which APHA and many other organizations signed on to in 2007, and we think that it is a reasonable starting point, again, from CPAS point of view, to think about the agenda that we may want to promote in a new administration. And I'll give you the website in a minute where you can look at these things. We have also started working on rewriting the Trade Act, which will be up for review next year, according to these principles. So just to run through them, that we think global trade and the agreements that we negotiate should be geared to achieving sustainable economic development, and that's the broadest goal, that we want to achieve democratic participation by public health and transparency in trade policy, that national, regional, and local governments should have the sovereignty to protect population health. Again, an example with the NAFTA case of where trade agreements can intervene with public health authorities making these kinds of decisions. And then in particular sectors that we need to protect vital human services, such as healthcare, water supply, and sanitation from being included in these trade agreements, that we need to promote access to affordable medicines, protect tobacco control, and also protect alcohol beverage control, all of these being examples of the kinds of regulations that could be countervened by trade agreements. We have a listserv, in case you're not already signed up on it. This is how you can do it. This is how you can get in touch with CPATH. There's also a list, again, going around if you want to become part of the APHA Trade and Health Forum. And with that, want to see if there are questions for Joel or for me. Thanks.
We have, what we're doing is basically 20 minutes on each presenter, so this has been 15 minutes, and we have 5 minutes for questions.
Or comments. Diatribes? Objections?
So, of course, NAFTA has the famous Chapter 11 part. So this suit is not under Chapter
11? No, this is under Chapter 11, yes.
Joel discussed Chapter 11 a little bit, but do people need a little bit more on that? People clear? Okay. Please. Jack.
Well, I don't believe, you don't sue the provincial governments, you sue the national government under Chapter 11, and I'm not sure, since there have been no, I'm not sure what happens under Chapter 11. I mean, there have been suits.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm not sure, were they cash settlements?
In some cases, there were. The Metalclad case was one where, again, it comes straight out of the public coffers. The tax dollars of Canadians will go to the particular corporation that has filed the suit. There can be alternative settlements if they would prefer to have Canada impose sanctions, other kinds of trade sanctions on the U.S., as is true at the WTO level. They could choose to do that. But corporations have said, no, we want our $16 million or $150 million, and if they win their case, the taxpayers of that country pay the corporation the settlement.
The difficulty in Canada is that healthcare, under the Constitution, healthcare services or the provision of healthcare services are provincial. So the federal government has no direct control over what the provinces do or don't do with respect to allowing for-profit healthcare delivery. But it's the federal government that gets sued.
Right, they're on the hook for the bill, which makes it possible to go for these large settlements.
Mr. Chair, can you talk a little bit more about tobacco control and what kind of research has been done in terms of health impact?
About tobacco control?
Control.
Sure. The question was to talk a little bit more about tobacco control and the impact of these trade agreements on tobacco control. It's a question, it's two things. One is an issue of tariffs, because there are tariffs on both tobacco leaf and, more importantly, tobacco products. And actually, it's gotten to be kind of an interesting situation, because with the breakup of Philip Morris, it's not clear that there are international tobacco companies anymore. But basically, to the extent that there have been, international tobacco companies have fought for removing tariffs from trade with other countries, which, of course, just to draw the picture, makes tobacco products cheaper. And what happens when tobacco products are cheaper? They're used more, and more people get sick and die as a result of smoking. But that's only part of it. The other part of it is, and a lot of the effort of public health over the last years has been to work on price, but also to work on things like advertising, which could be subject to intellectual property rules. And even before TRIPS was put into place, there was the case of Carla Hills, the former U.S. Trade Representative, writing a letter again to Canada, basically saying, if you go forward with plain packaging, we're going to consider that a violation of the GATT, because you're infringing on our rights to on our trademark rights. So there are a whole other range of intellectual property violations, services violations, if we want to say you can only restrict the sale of cigarettes to certain age groups. Is that something that's permissible as a domestic regulation? So there have been actual cases where there have been threats and trade charges. There was another NAFTA case from Canada, a company in Canada challenging the Master Settlement Agreement in the U.S. as being discriminatory. So there's been a fair amount of work. We've got an article. There's some some stuff on our website, and I know that there have been some presentations here, so there's a lot to draw on, and happy to be in touch with you about that. Out of time? Other questions?
I can do one more question.
Okay. Dr. Wiest.
Has anyone, maybe you have, Ellen, Joe, sat down and looked at the agreements to try to figure out if there's any way what's written into this trade agreements that public health could use to file suits or form some organization that could, I mean, something to use the trade agreements themselves to promote?
So the question is, can we actually use the trade agreements to promote public health? I think there have been some attempts by the World Health Organization to collaborate with the World Trade Organization on these kinds of questions. For example, there have been meetings that the WTO has called to look at the migration of healthcare workers and think about how that should be regulated. I think the issue is, and this came up in Jack's session yesterday, there's a need for coordination across borders. The problem is when you've got the finance ministry sitting down with the health ministry, there's just a difference in point of view and there's a difference in power and funding. And the question is how the health community needs to position ourselves sort of vis-a-vis those offices. So it's a possibility. I don't know if other people have thoughts about what the prospects would be or know of cases or opportunities that have been taken advantage of. Intellectual property is access to medicines is probably another good example where there's certainly going to be commercial involvement, and I think the World Health Organization has issued some good reports and done a lot of good work from their own offices bringing people together and thinking about how to deal with that issue. I think it's remained pretty oppositional to the WTO and to the pharmaceutical industry. Marianne Mercer, you had a thought?
Yeah, I mean, it just occurs to me as you're talking that I think one contribution that can be made by groups that are working every day in developing countries, field staff, people there, is to get them to get stories, get them to tell stories about what happens. Let them know, okay, this has changed, what's happening. I mean, we've got lots of stories from, for example, Mozambique when trade laws were changed, but we haven't gotten them into this discourse about, the stories from the field about. I think a lot of people are going to understand that much easier than they're going to understand the legality.
Right.
When a lot of it is cashew export.
Right.
And then, all this factory was changed, and, there's lots and lots of stories.
Yeah, on the negative side, I think, for those of you who heard Dr. Marmot on Sunday, both talking about the loss of revenues from getting rid of tariffs and also just the disruption of agriculture. So there's a lot of, I think you're talking about sort of negative examples that we can draw from the field. Bill's question is, are there positive aspects as well? And I think we have a lot of chances to talk about all this in the coming year, because certainly there's going to be a great deal of ferment. Thank you very much.
I'll get us out of here.